It's a magazine. You don't have to feel obligated to buy from your nephew's fundraiser. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, free on your radio. Now. Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Saturday to you. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Craig Battle and Ben Nicholson-Smith. This week, lots to get to today. I know it's been almost a week, but we will get our brief thoughts on the Maple Leafs trading of Mike Santarelli, Cody Franz into the Predators. They lost again. Another must-lose game. You can chalk it up. Put it in the L column as they creep ever closer to the bottom three in the National Hockey League, doing a good job of tanking. Pitchers and catchers report to Dunedin on Sunday. That's tomorrow, people. Yes, there is baseball to talk about. Fake games about a week away. Crazy, crazy NBA trade deadline, and we'll probably give you our thoughts on Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao doing it up on May 2nd. But we start, and I was kind of making note of this before the show, that it's not very often we start with the Raptors, but it's getting to the point where the Leafs are, without question, the afterthought in this city. But the Raptors, first game after the All-Star break, go into Atlanta, the best teams in the NBA. They were 43-11 headed into yesterday. They are now 43-12 because the Raptors hammered them 105-80. Raptors now 37-17. And while 5.5 games is a fair amount, they're still in the discussion for that number one seed in the Eastern Conference. Craig, just overall takeaways from a game, maybe one of the Raptors' best all-around efforts this season, and they take the season series 3-1 against a Hawks team. Nobody else has won two games against them this year.
That's a pretty incredible thing. You know, people before last night's game were saying the Raptors had two wins on this team, but it was when Atlanta was still sort of figuring itself out before it had gotten really going. There was a little bit of an asterisk. And now all of a sudden it's a 3-1 series win for the Raptors. Really handling too. Like the score, the point spread in this game was just astronomical. A 25-point win. The third quarter alone was 28-13. The Raptors, the first half was awfully close. Both teams making a couple of mistakes, committing turnovers. But it really kind of seemed like the Atlanta Hawks were going to be able to turn it around. But the defense was the calling card for the Raptors last night. And I think we owe a lot of that to the reinsertion of James Johnson into the starting lineup. He offers so much different skill set than Grievous Vasquez does. He's got long arms. He's quick. He can check. You know, there was times when he was checking Jeff Teague, the point guard. He was checking Kyle Korver. He's running Korver off the three-point line. Korver had a terrible shooting night. And you can sort of, like, obviously people have bad nights, shooting wide open shots, but you can put some of that on the Raptors defense and Dwayne Casey's sometimes maligned plan to run guys off the line and then, trap and recover. So basically they had a great night against you said it, Ben, the one of the best teams in the league. They had the second best record in the NBA going into last night. Neither of these teams made any moves at the deadline. So this is who you're looking at. There's no players to integrate. They know who they are. Going down the stretch of this season, it suddenly looks a lot closer. That would have been a big swing. The Hawks could have had a 7.5 game lead at this point in the season. Now they're 5.5 up. They look more vulnerable. And this is going to be a crazy finish. People were saying, oh yeah, the Raptors are going to finish third, maybe fourth in the division now. Sorry, the conference now that the Cavs are picking it up. But suddenly the Raptors look right back in their last stretch, makes them look right back in it for the number one seed.
And Ben, they've won four straight, and they've had extended winning streaks this season. They won six straight against, I think, every single team during that string was sub 500. You look at their last four here, beat the Clippers, beat the Spurs, beat the Wizards, have the All-Star break, beat the Hawks. I mean, it's getting tougher and tougher to doubt this team as a top two team in the Eastern Conference.
Yeah, it really is. They're looking really good out there. Obviously, like Craig said, last night, a huge win for this team. And I think that doing it against the top competition kind of reinforces their status as a team that you really have to look at as a club that not only can potentially win a first round series, but you have to think if they make it to the second round, and not to get ahead of ourselves here, but if they do, they're a team that you could potentially be watching for a long time come playoff time.
It's an interesting situation. I think you're onto something there, Craig, with the James Johnson insertion into the starting five, right? Because not only does it add something at the defensive end, but you're allowing Grievous Vasquez to come off the bench, mm-hmm. and it was Grievous Vasquez in the starting five was not just messing with the starting five, but it was messing with your bench, right? Because you'd have to bring one of those guys out early, mm-hmm. give him a rest, and then bring him back in to replace the other guy, and it was. I mean, there were times where James Johnson wasn't playing. I mean, he wasn't even in the rotation at times with this team not too long ago.
Which is something that absolutely can't happen.
Yeah.
He was sort of a low on the radar offseason signing. You know, not a lot of people were like, oh, James Johnson is going to be a massive part of this team. It was sort of like he's the end of the bench. He might provide something because he didn't have the greatest exit from Toronto the first time he was here. But he provides something that Terrence Ross didn't provide, and that's why Terrence Ross came out of the starting lineup. He wasn't providing the defense that he potentially can give the team down the road. You get James Johnson's he drives to the hole. He's good on offense, but he's got that defensive acumen that Grievous Vasquez doesn't have. And then what it does for you too is in that second unit last night, Lewis Williams was going completely insane. He's hitting shots from everywhere. That sort of step back corner three that he nailed in the first half is just something that nobody should take, but nobody's going to hit. Like, it's just, he's going insane. So when Lewis Williams is going like that, you can just let him go. But what was happening before was they were winding up with Lewis Williams, Kyle Lowry, and Grievous Vasquez playing at all the same time. And none of those guys, especially with Kyle Lowry sort of a bit gassed after DeRozan's absence earlier this season, are stopping anything on the perimeter. So you wind up having way too much pressure on the back end of your team. That's sort of not going to happen anymore. You can run out Grievous or Lewis Williams if they're having a hot night. You can cycle in. You can bring in Terrence Ross for a couple of minutes. You don't need to over-rely on Grievous Vasquez, and you don't need to bring in Lewis Williams at a time when you're going to wind up with one of those three-point guard lineups. You can bring those guys in at the tail end when you bring Lowry out, and then you wind up with Lewis Williams playing off the ball and shooting shots and not having to handle the ball.
It was an unbelievable game. Lou Williams, 7 of 10 from 3, 9 of 14 overall from the field. There was a negative, though. Bruno Caboclo's in the D-League. It was a 30-point game in the fourth quarter. That was prime Bruno Caboclo time, right? It's a shame.
It is a shame, yeah. We needed to see him. The Human Victory Cigar Trophy wound up going to Greg Steemsma last night.
Yeah.
Bruno, I feel bad for him in the D-League. I feel like that's not really his spot.
It's not like I would say the AHL is a developmental league, and I know developmental is right in the title of the league, but yeah, it seems like it's a bunch of guys just trying to put up their own numbers, and difficult way for a youngster to learn his craft.
And we've talked about this before, where the Raptors share a development league team with about half the league.
Yes.
So you wind up with half the league's Bruno Caboclo's trying to get shots up. And, you know, like, no matter how much Masai Ujiri implores the coach, we really want to see this guy in this situation. That guy has 14 other general managers,
right,
in his ear. So yeah, I'd love to see Bruno, coming in for his corner three and, you know, getting an alley-oop or something like that at the end of a game like this. But, you know, he's not getting a lot of run either way.
We will talk in depth about the NBA trade deadline. The biggest in the history of the league is like almost 10% of the league's players were changing teams on deadline day. But one of the few teams that did not make any moves, well, in fact, two of them actually hooked up yesterday, the Raptors and the Atlanta Hawks. But Ben, we look at this Raptors team, and I don't know if it's fairly, maybe it's unfairly, maybe it is the reason why they've been so successful the last almost two full years now, is that they like each other. There's a chemistry thing going on. And I know you add a couple of guys, James Johnson and Lou Williams, they seem to have integrated themselves well into this lineup, but Raptors stand pat. There's a risk involved in standing pat as well. I get that, and maybe we'll get to that in just a second. But are you glad at least we get to see what this team is, if this collection of players is good enough to win a round or two in the playoffs?
I think it's the right move because you have a team that's working together. I think it's almost like a lesser version of Golden State where, you know, Klay Thompson comes out and he says, we're doing great. We didn't need any help. And I think the Raptors are in a similar situation. They're winning games, especially of late, like you mentioned. I think they're well positioned to see what this group can do going forward. So it's a good thing they didn't trade someone like Ross or they didn't give up future picks. They're staying the course, not only for now, but they're by preserving what they have, they're kind of setting themselves up to be in a good position a couple seasons down the road as well.
Yeah, Craig, your thoughts, the no movement at the deadline.
I was kind of two minds, you know, like I could have seen them and I didn't need them to make a big move. Like there was all talk that they were, you know, tied to Kenneth Faried in Denver or, yeah, you know, like pie in the sky. They were going to somehow steal Taj Gibson away from a conference rival in the Bulls. I didn't need to see a big move like that. I kind of thought that they could use some more rebounding in the front court. I was thinking sort of a low end move like Ed Davis from the Lakers. If you can try to pry him back for a second round pick or something, obviously the Lakers don't need anybody to you know, add stats or to help them win games. They're trying to keep their pick and it's protected 1-5. So if they actually wind up winning a game or two, they might wind up dropping out of that. And then now that pick goes to the 76ers. Anyway, I could have seen them getting sort of something like that for a guy like Ed Davis who could come in and rebound. But the other hand, you saw it last year with the Indiana Pacers, who were in a very similar position to the Raptors right now. Way up, you know, completely, you know, cruising. They wound up trading Danny Granger, who was a longtime Pacer, you know, drafted as a Pacer, you know, had been going through some injuries and stuff like that and wasn't really contributing. They traded him for Evan Turner. Evan Turner came in and apparently just upset the chemistry. It wasn't that Evan Turner was a bad guy. It just sort of...
Turner might be a bad guy, though.
Well, he might be a bad guy. He was his nickname was the Villain at Ohio State.
Yes, that's what I mean.
So, you know, it's possible. So Evan Turner, potentially bad guy, who knows, just upset the chemistry in the locker room. And basically he wanted moves, or sorry, he wanted touches. There weren't touches for him. And the team, you know, whether it's wholly on this chemistry issue or not, they went in a complete nosedive. And by the time the playoffs came around, they looked like a terrible team. They were on something, you know, a non-playoff trajectory by the time they got there and then wound up being the league's worst ever one seed.
Right. They were horrible. And who knows, maybe they make a playoff run here if Paul George gets healthy down the stretch. All right, so I want to take the other side of it, though. Yes, it is. I mean, it's hard to knock them and Masai Ujiri for not making a move, right? Because this team has played extremely well, and they proved it again. Another outstanding game yesterday against the Hawks. But, I mean, there is another side to this because the rest of the Eastern Conference got better, and for the Miami Heat, they got tangibly better. They had some of the worst guard play in the NBA headed into the trade deadline. They got a whole lot better because they got Goran Dragic. Next season, who knows what the Eastern Conference is going to look like? Will we have the bottom two seeds again sub-500? Probably not. You're going to have another year of development in Washington, Cleveland, Chicago, I mean Atlanta. Who knows? Maybe this is the year that the Raptors, when they look back in a couple of years, will say, man, we kind of missed out on an opportunity there. We could have added a couple of pieces at the deadline and really taken that next step from not just, you know, one of the three to as an assertive number one in the Eastern Conference. It's dangerous thinking, I know, Ben, but it's hard not to be tantalized by the fact that, as is, this team is already 20 games over 500. Where would they be if they were able to pull off a move for a bigger name?
So when you say bigger name, this is what I'm wondering. I mean, yeah, who's the name out there that would have helped the Raptors that was available and that they would have been able to obtain without giving up some kind of big-time future piece?
Well, Craig, yeah, who is that guy? I mean, who's the mortgage the franchise guy that you could have gone out and gotten? I guess it's somebody in the front court, right? Because you're pretty happy with your guard play. It's a big man. Who is that? It's like Mozgov type if he was out there, right?
Yeah, you'd love to have a Mozgov backing up Jonas Valanciunas. But that's the thing is that Cleveland went out and snatched him away from Denver early. And it took two first-round picks to do it, which I don't think Masai Ujiri was going to be comfortable
with. But that's
doing
the type of move I'm talking about, right?
Right. But so, yeah, like I think Ben said it in a way that...
Which Ben? There's two Bens here.
Good point. Ben Nicholson-Smith said it. Who is that guy? So I said it before. I said Taj Gibson. I never gave a hope that that was going to happen. Like, I love Taj Gibson. He rebounds. He's got long arms. He's a good guy. Crazy energy. But there was no way Chicago, number three in the East, is going to give you Taj Gibson for nothing. Like, you want to add him for Terrence Ross or something like that. Not that Terrence Ross is nothing, but right now, not a huge part of the rotation.
Yeah.
So you're going to add him for a outside rotation piece and expiring contracts and maybe a draft pick. I don't think that's going to happen. Kenneth Faried, as he adds energy, he adds rebounding, but he wasn't going to boost your defense, and he might, he's not a shooter either, so he might muck up Jonas Valanciunas.
Those guys don't age all that well.
No, yeah, like he's an athlete, right? Like, you know, the Manimal, you know, you don't get a name like the Manimal if you're sort of like a high sort of, like, if you're known for your basketball, like, right? Like,
no.
He's a guy who's going to get in there and mess things up. He's going to sort of, he's going to outleap your other guys. He's going to outwork your other guys. And that sort of doesn't sort of carry on. And he's got a long-term contract. So they would have had to swallow a lot of money to do that. So other guys mentioned, people were talking about Kevin Garnett coming here. People were talking about David West coming here. But those aren't big pieces, right? You look at the bottom half, the teams that were obviously sellers, they weren't looking to send their major pieces. You weren't getting DeMarcus Cousins from Sacramento. You're not getting Anthony Davis. You couldn't sell the entire team for Anthony Davis.
Yeah. Like,
the pieces that were going to make you better now and last into the future weren't out there on trade rumors. And half the East right now is hoping for that eighth spot. So that eliminates like four potential trade partners at least.
Yeah, absolutely does. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Annis alongside Craig Battle and Ben Nicholson-Smith. But let's, I know we got so much more of the regular season and the playoffs and all that, but I think part of Masai Ujiri's thinking is also looking forward to the offseason here, Craig. And you look at all the unrestricted free agents here. Mm-hmm. You look at Amir Johnson's going to be the big question mark. Lou Williams setting himself up for a nice payday.
Mm-hmm.
And who knows what the landscape, the financial landscape of the NBA is in a couple of years when the CBA players are obviously going to opt out. There's going to be a whole lot more money. The cap might be going up by as much as $30 million, which is an insane amount. And who knows what max player salaries looks like. All of that. I mean, it is going to be a very interesting offseason for this team.
It's going to be an incredibly interesting offseason, just not just for the Raptors, but for the NBA. I was looking at the numbers the other day, and I think we all know how insane last year's free agency was. There were some massive names, LeBron James, Carmelo Anthony, Chris Bosh, Dwayne Wade. But there was 87 free agents. This summer, there will be 157 free agents. Massive amounts of players changing teams. The Raptors have a ton. So they've got Amir Johnson. They've got Lewis Williams. They've got Tyler Hansbrough, Landry Fields, Chuck Hayes. A ton of guys that are coming off their cap and a lot of money. So you're looking towards sort of what they're going to achieve. You know, they'd love to be able to get Lewis Williams back. But his play right now, is he going to command a sort of like a $9, $10 million salary?
And could be sixth man of the year.
He could be sixth man of the year. That's an absolutely great point. Like, he is currently, you know, in the upper echelons of win shares, PER. He's averaging a crazy amount of points. He's shooting extremely well from three-point range. He's making a lot of fans. And you could see it last night when he was in Atlanta. He really wanted to get out there and prove to that team that they gave up on him, that they gave up on him too soon, and that, you know, he wanted to kind of shove
it. Drake's writing songs about him.
Absolutely. So they would love to have both of those guys back, but they'll be looking towards we were talking about now. They'll be looking towards front court. They'll be looking towards a backup center. They'll be hoping for some advancement, some development from Lucas Nogueira and Bruno Caboclo to better fill that sort of 3-4 spot and then the backup center spot. But they'll be looking for a power forward who can, you know, stretch the floor and who can defend and rebound. But they are going to be one of a million teams looking for that guy. We talked about it. The Lakers are going to be with a ton of cap space. The Knicks are going to have a ton of cap space. They just bought out Amari Stoudemire, right? There's so many teams in massive markets who are going to be looking towards the LaMarcus Aldridges of the world and the Marc Gasols. Goran Dragic is a backcourt piece. Rajon Rondo is a free agent. So while there are a ton of a ton of free agents. There aren't a ton of marquee free agents. So it's going to be an interesting offseason where there isn't really a slam dunk. It's not like there's been a team, a player tied to the Raptors that, you know, oh yeah, they're going to run out and grab that guy and he's going to immediately upgrade that position.
Right. Andrew Wiggins isn't a free agent until 2020, right?
Exactly. So, and that's a slam dunk, obviously.
Yeah, you know, obviously.
We can predict that 2020. Just keep the $15 million open or whatever it is. So yeah, it's interesting when you say, when we talk about sort of should the Raptors have gone for it at this trade deadline? Should they have found that piece? Should they have mortgaged the future? Because the plan this summer doesn't seem like it's set in stone, that it's laid out for them. They're going to have a massive part of their core with them next season. But how do they get better? How do they add pieces? Isn't laid out for them. It's not a foregone conclusion that they can find these pieces this summer.
Yeah, it seemed like Masai Ujiri was kind of laying the groundwork for this offseason being the big time of change. And he's obviously a guy who's not afraid to you know, mix with the chemistry or make big moves. He made the Rudy Gay trade. Well, he had a trade in place to send Kyle Lowry to the Knicks. But, he's a guy who can obviously pull the trigger on a big-time trade. I mean, sent Melo out of town in Denver as well. Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. So the Raptors now 37-17. They're second in the Eastern Conference, Ben, and 5.5 games back of the Atlanta Hawks. That's all well and good. It is great. I mean, it's super fun to watch. They've got the attention of the city, and it's easy to do so when Maple Leafs do not have a road win in 2015. They have two under Peter Horacek, which is still unbelievable. And we'll get to the Maple Leafs at the bottom of the hour here. But here we are, like I said, second in the Eastern Conference. Right now, they would have a first-round matchup with the Miami Heat, which might not be so great. But it almost seems at this point that the regular season doesn't matter. I mean, it's fun to watch, and it's fun to see the individual games, and looking forward to seeing the Golden State Warriors here in town in a couple of weeks and going on the road and seeing how they fare against the best teams in the NBA. But if they even finish first in the Eastern Conference and lose in seven games in the first round of the playoffs, the season is a disappointment, right? It almost doesn't matter what they do here. It all comes down to what they do in the playoffs.
For sure. I completely agree that if they were to finish with the one seed and set a franchise record for wins and have all kinds of personal accomplishments and still bowed out in the first round, it would be a failure. So I think what they can accomplish now before the end of the season is keep their guys healthy, get some more fourth quarter time for guys like Jonas Valanciunas and get them into that mix, make sure they're ready for the playoffs, and then also establish a good seed for yourself, because I don't think you want to slip to the 3-4 range. I know they've been playing so well, that doesn't seem like too much of a concern at this very moment, but they have a tough slate of games ahead.
Yeah.
You want to maintain that position, and then you can potentially, and we are getting ahead of ourselves here, but potentially escape from that first round series relatively unharmed, get yourself some rest, and then enter the second round with full momentum.
Yeah, that being said, Craig, I mean, if you win a first round series, then it's all gravy, right? Like, that's the whole, going into this season, that was the goal. The goal has not changed, I feel like, even though, yes, there are in-season goals. Sure, you'd like to finish 1-2. That would be great. Second seed in the Eastern Conference would be great. And that being said, again, like right now, Raptors would face the Heat in the first round. That is not a gimme. That is not, I mean, they would be slight favorites over the Heat, and who knows, Chris Bosh is back, and yeah, we hope that everything's okay with him, with the blood clots potentially in the lungs there. But I mean, Hassan Whiteside, they add Goran Dragic. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a frightening team if you bow out in the first round.
It's a terrifying team to see in the first round. That's what Twitter was blowing up with. Once they added Goran Dragic for pretty much spare parts, and that team, that starting lineup, Goran Dragic, who was a third team All-NBA last year. You've got Dwayne Wade, future Hall of Famer, who right now it just seems like is resting. Like they're just keeping him out. Like there's injuries. There's always lingering injuries with Dwayne Wade.
Yeah.
But right now he's just resting after the playoffs. Luol Deng is a fantastic LeBron James replacement. Then you've got Chris Bosh potentially. You know, all thoughts go out to Chris Bosh and hope that medical situation alleviates itself and that he can play again this season. And then you've got Hassan Whiteside, who out of nowhere is playing like...
Could have been a Raptor.
But could have been anybody. Could have been a King. Could have been a Hornet. Could have been anybody, right?
But like, he did work out with the Raptors, right?
Yeah, he played Summer League with the Raptors. Yeah. So, and the Summer League team for the Raptors, he didn't show out. He didn't look bad. He was just there, right? It was
yeah.
a summer league team that nobody really separated himself. I think they signed Will Cherry out of it, who's no longer with the team. But so, yeah, right now he's playing more like Anthony Davis than he is like the great Steamsma end of the bench center that we signed.
Yeah,
right?
He's starting for that team.
He's starting for that team. He's putting up 20-20 games. Like that is a fantastic find. You know, he's like, he always had the size. He always had the quickness. You know, soft touch, all that sort of stuff. And it was just that he seemed immature. You know, like there's stories going about Hassan Whiteside back to the draft days where he assumed he was going to be a lottery pick and he just basically phoned in all his workouts. So just there was a mental component that was totally lacking for him, and that, you know, going overseas and, you know, being humbled really seems to have changed him. And now he's working as hard as any center in the league and he's playing fantastically for them. So that starting five, and we've seen it from the Heat in the past, Eric Spoelstra will totally shrink down their rotation to play their best players. And then so you can have Mario Chalmers coming off the bench and playing a few minutes. You can have, who else do they have even in that backcourt? That is a thin, thin team. But, you know, that doesn't matter as much in the playoffs. So you wind up with Eric Spoelstra, who's a proven strategist, a two-time NBA champion coach, and then two future Hall of Famers, Goran Dragic and Sam Whiteside. That is amazing for a first-round matchup. You know, everybody right now is hoping that winds up being Miami-Cleveland, just so you get...
Yes, that'd be good.
That would be amazing. But even Cleveland doesn't want to see that team in the first round if he's healthy.
Well, and even if the Heat catch Milwaukee or whatever, and Milwaukee falls to that seventh seed, is that a team you want to face in the first round?
No, it isn't.
you got to face somebody, I guess.
You got to face somebody. Right now, the Raptors seem to have Washington's number, but Washington looks like they're sort of locked in for that five seed. Yeah. It doesn't look likely that the Raptors will wind up playing them, at least at this point. But Milwaukee gave the Raptors fits. They had eight guys playing last time they played. And the way they play, they're long-armed, they're athletic.
They added Reggie Jackson as well, although lost Brandon Knight.
They added Michael Carter-Williams, but lost Brandon Knight. Reggie Jackson went to Detroit Pistons.
Yes.
Who was another scary team.
Sorry, yes.
But anyway, so yeah, Milwaukee, they've got, they've lost players this season. They don't have Larry Sanders. They don't have Jabari Parker, but they're one of the hottest teams in the NBA. They're 9-1 in their last 10. They've won the last four. One of those was against the Raptors, and that was when they were highly depleted. They play a really frenetic style of defense that's got them, you know, one of the best defensive teams in the league. And that's proven to give the Raptors problems. The Raptors are, one of the best offensive teams in the league, consistently score over 100 points. They scored like 80 the last time they played Milwaukee. And Jason Kidd, we know him. We've seen him in the past. He coached Brooklyn to a first-round series win over the Raptors last season. He's coaching Milwaukee now. He knows this team. He's scouted this team really, really well. And they can give teams problems. They're by no means unbeatable. They're not the, you know, 96 Bulls, but they've got a much better outlook on a first round team. They're not your typical six seed, or they don't play like it.
It'd be fun playoff time, no question. Partly because the weather will be good, we assume. People will be outside at Jurassic Park as I look out the window and it's snowing once again. Mm-hmm. Good times. We'll talk baseball at the top of the hour as well, which will make us all feel all that warmer. But coming up next, Maple Leafs lose again. Big deal. Big whoop. You almost can't find the games now at the bars because nobody really cares. The point is to lose. They lost another must lose. But I think the more interesting story is what Paul Maurice had to say about his time in Toronto in regards to dealing with the Toronto media. We'll play you those comments, react to them. Also, talk about Brendan Leipzig scoring his first goal yesterday for the Marlies, and maybe touch on the trade last week, Santorelli and Franzen to the Predators. All that and more coming up. We're with you until noon. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live alongside Craig Battle and Ben Nicholson-Smith. I am Ben Ennis on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet magazine, here's Dave Zirum.
You spend time with your family?
Sure I do.
Good. Because a man that doesn't spend time with his family can never be a real man.
Easy there, Godfather. You don't need to tell the Toronto Raptors about the importance of family. That's because, with the majority of the players and coaches either newly married or with young children in tow, there's never been a bigger family presence on this team. But there's more to it than that. The franchise has worked hard to create an inclusive, welcoming atmosphere for the players and their families. And it all starts with the Raps Team Services Department, who go above and beyond the call of duty to help acclimate new players to the city and ensure that familiar faces are looked after. On previous teams, Dwayne Casey would urge his wife Brenda to stay out of the family room. That's where problems start, he'd tell her. Well, you won't hear that from the Raptors, not this season at least. So join us as we go behind the scenes with the Raptors' friends, family, and the support group that's helping them find success on and off the court. Because if there's one thing the Raptors are proving, it's that family matters. We'll make you happy.
This story and more appears in the latest edition of Sportsnet magazine, available on Next Issue and in the Apple Newsstand.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Craig Battle and Ben Nicholson Smith. Get to your baseball preview, I guess. We'll talk about the new rules in place to help speed up the game. All that and more coming up at the top of the clock. The Maple Leafs lose yet again. Man, they are good at these must-lose things. Carolina right there with them at the bottom of the NHL standings. And a four-point swing yesterday. The Leafs lose 2-1. Kane's now 2 points back of the Leafs with two games in hand. They currently sit in that fourth worst spot in the NHL. Zona very catchable as well. They're just 4 points back of the Maple Leafs with a game in hand as well. And single digits now between the Maple Leafs and Edmonton Oilers somehow. 7 points separating the Leafs and Oilers. They lose, as mentioned, yesterday. Guys, I was at a bar, restaurant, and yesterday, and I was watching the Raptor game. It was on a bunch of TVs, and it took me a second to realize, well, the Leafs are actually playing tonight, aren't they? And I looked at my dad, and he said, yeah, what's going on there? We saw a screen that said it was 2-1 in the first intermission. It had not been on. And this is, I mean, in the GTA, a bar that would have normally played the Maple Leaf game, there would have been some sort of human cry to put it on. Nobody cared. Nobody notices, Ben. Nobody cares anymore about this team.
They're an afterthought, essentially. It's especially when it comes to watching the games on the ice. I mean, we'll talk about them, and they're interesting, but they're not a team that you want to watch play. And I'm in the same boat. I mean, I'm going to go out, and I'm way more likely to watch the Raptors than the Leafs. And in fact, if the Leafs are on, you might leave and go to a place with the Raptors.
It brings up the interesting discussion about whether people will watch a rebuild. Why hasn't a rebuild ever been done in this city? Will people put up with a team that's unwatchable? I get that people are fading on this team right now because the idea is to keep losing games and there's not a lot of youth on it. If this team is lousy again next year, Craig, but it has the younger players, it has the William Nylanders, maybe a Connor McDavid or somebody of that ilk, it's going to be a top five pick, you would imagine, either way. Is that a more watchable team, even if they are as lousy this year, as long as there's young pieces that you can look and kind of project towards a time where this team actually is good?
Yeah, I think it's about sort of the differing expectations and the way the expectations for this team have changed over the past, let's say, 2 months. This was a team that was supposed to challenge for the playoffs, so you're watching a team, you know, hoping that they win. You know, like you're watching the standings, you're watching the game, you're really hoping that, okay, we need to eke this one out so we can get back in that, you know, eighth spot, seventh spot, whatever it was. But over the past 2 months of losing and the past couple of weeks of sort of, this organization is plainly not playing for this season. They're looking to trade off guys. They traded Franson and Santarelli. This is a team that does, you know, obviously the players want to win, the coaches want to win. But this is a team that that actually is best served losing and getting a high draft pick. So you don't necessarily want to watch the game because you want them to lose. You don't want to watch them lose. But also you don't really want to see it if they win because then that's counterproductive.
Yeah, it's a weird kind of purgatory that Maple Leaf fans find themselves in. You mentioned the trade. Brendan Leipsic, one of the pieces brought back from the Nashville Predators, scored in his Marlies debut yesterday. They also get another first-round pick, and they get Olli Jokinen, who's just a guy who we expect to be gone before the March 2nd trade deadline. Overall, I mean, this is the type of move that we're going to see a whole bunch of, right, as we head towards March 2nd, right, Craig?
Yeah, I sure hope so. I hope they can get some younger guys and some draft picks. And I feel like, to your question earlier, if we can be seeing these guys, these younger guys coming up and playing next season and start the season with the expectation that, here we go, we've got a young team, they're up and coming, we've made moves, we've jettisoned the old core that you got tired of watching. This is an exciting team. We're gonna get up and down. We're not gonna win all the time. We know that this is a young team. We don't have the pieces to win, but you're gonna see some exciting hockey and you're gonna see the future of the franchise. I think I, as a fan, and the city as a fan base, will get behind that. I think you can watch young guys and see where they're going. And, you know, so Nylander's playing next season. Well, how did Nylander play? We gotta find out how Nylander played. You know, Leipzig, and maybe he gets in and you get.
Well, and that being said, maybe today's Marley game is more interesting than the Leaf game tonight as they play the Winnipeg Jets. Marlies play Texas at 3 o'clock this afternoon, seeing all those young players and William Nylander and Brendan Leipzig. Mentioned that the Jets are in town tonight. That means our old good pal who was in the media for a second and a half, Paul Maurice, in town with the Winnipeg Jets. Done a pretty good job there as their head coach. And he was asked yesterday about his time in Toronto and specifically about dealing with the media and how you how it affects you as a head coach here in Toronto.
I mean, it's so you'd say there's not necessarily any more pressure in terms of your desire to win games. I mean, that doesn't change regardless of the market that you're in, but from controlling a message inside your room is so much more difficult when you know that anything as a coach that you say becomes 10 more cameras and 3 more stalls. So if you're saying something good about a player, he's a rock star, you know? And if a guy has a tough night and you want to deal with the media honestly, you got to be careful about how hard you go at his play, because then the next day, or maybe even that day, it's a drive-by shooting. You know, I mean, it is. I mean, they'll find something that's not going. It's 40 people in the stall figuring out whether they should trade them, play them, or execute them. And that's a challenge for controlling that room. It is. It takes a while to get a handle on it. I don't know that I ever did. I thought Pat Quinn was probably the best at it because, for the most part, everybody was a little afraid of him. He might have come across the podium, so that helped. And then I think he also got to a point he really didn't care, so he said what he wanted. I enjoyed watching how he dealt with that, but it's a real, real difference between coaching there. Then second to that are Canadian markets, and then after that are, you know, the traditional U.S. markets, and then the non-traditional. There's a major difference in terms of what you have to deal with in terms of controlling the message in your room.
There you go. That was Paul Maurice yesterday talking about his time in Toronto as a head coach of the Maple Leafs and dealing with the media. And I guess the headline coming out of it is, yeah, he called it a drive-by shooting, right? So that's what makes headlines. And that's actually, I mean, clickbait, it worked. That's what made me click on that story and listen to the comments. Overall, though, your take, because I get my back up a little bit, and I wonder if people outside of this room care about that. I think they do. Like, people on Twitter, I mean, that's my gauge from the outside world. It's tough for us because we actually work in the media, right? So it's obviously going to be interesting to us. But I think it is interesting that not only is it, you know, the perception of people in the media that it affects free agency and it can affect the actual play on the ice. If people in the league are talking about how the media deals with this team, maybe it is a thing, Ben.
I think it's a thing to some extent. Obviously, it can't be an easy place to play when everyone is focused on your every move. And, you know, a trade like last week, Franzen and Santorelli, this isn't Sidney Crosby and Evgeny Malkin, but it gets analyzed and discussed. And every single thing that the Leafs do is going to be under the microscope. But that can go both ways. I mean, if this team was playing well, I have no doubt that there would be glowing profiles written about James Reimer or Nazem Kadri or whoever the star of the moment was. So I think it just amplifies the issues. It's like, if the team is doing a great job, then you're going to see the good things. If it's not doing well, you're going to see all the bad things. And right now, this is an awful team playing awful hockey. So what else can you expect?
It's, I don't know what you can say that's positive about this team right now. But on the other side, Craig, I mean, there's way worse places in North America, in the world, definitely. But in North America, even if we bring it closer to home, within, you know, a couple hundred miles, New York City can't be that easy to play. And if you're a New York Yankee, is being a Maple Leaf tougher than being a New York Yankee as far as a media perception?
No, I don't think it is. I feel like, yeah, if you're a regular everyday Yankee, you have a great game, you get lauded. You get the New York Post, you get the New York Times, you get ESPN.com front page, you get everything. You got, there's, you know, between wire services and bloggers and, you know, multiple media outlets, I think everywhere there's more media attention. So yeah, in your major centers, you're going to get this. But I don't think that that Toronto is all that special or unique in its sort of media proliferation. And you're seeing it elsewhere. Like, obviously, we've had run-ins with the Toronto media and the Maple Leafs these days. Phil Kessel, you know, lashed out. But that's happening elsewhere. Kevin Durant lashed out at NBA reporters. Marshawn Lynch lashed out at every single NFL reporter. Like, obviously, how much better is it to be a Maple Leaf than it is it to get asked 1,000 questions in an NFL media day? Like, those guys aren't being spared. So I feel like there's just more reporters, more outlets. It's a 24-hour news cycle. There's the, you know, every guy with a Twitter account is a reporter. You can share the stuff. You can pick out your one soundbite and write at large. That's happening everywhere. It's not like Evander Kane got a free pass in Winnipeg, right?
Sure.
I feel like, yeah, Toronto, there's a lot of reporters here, and there's a lot of reporters competing for hot takes and stuff like that. So sure, yeah, there's going to be bad times, but I don't think you're getting spared no matter where you are.
Speaking of hot takes, a whole bunch more of them coming up. We got another 60 minutes of hot takes, including top of the hour, our baseball hot takes, as pitchers and catchers officially report down to Dunedin tomorrow. Ben Nicholson-Smith goes early March, I guess we'll try to conceal our utter hatred for him for that. And we'll talk about the new rules to help speed up the game and all that. And baseball, who cares? We just talk about baseball. Look out your window. Don't you want to talk baseball? So we will do that. Coming up next, this is Sportsnet Magazine Live alongside Ben Nicholson-Smith and Craig Battle. I'm Ben Ennis on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
The top topics, the headiest headlines, the debatiest debate. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
It's Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Craig Battle and Ben Nicholson-Smith. Blue Jays pitchers and catchers reporting tomorrow. Yes, it's true. Hard to believe, but yeah. And then the first workout goes Monday. Full team, their first workout goes Friday. And first fake game for Blue Jays, March 3rd. At home against the Pirates at Florida Auto Exchange Stadium. So, yes, it is, it's right there. It's on the horizon. We can see the finish line here. And then the season gets underway second week of April, which is kind of a late start. April 6th at Yankee Stadium, Yankees home opener, and then the Blue Jays play 3 against the Yankees, 3 against the Orioles, return for 4 against the Rays. They play the Braves. That first month interleague play, well, we got to deal with it now with 15 teams in each league. So, yes, it's right there for us. Baseball story starting to bubble to the surface here. I guess the story yesterday, pretty big, whenever you're talking about changing the rules of the game, although they were changed marginally, not real big significant changes, but the idea is to increase the pace of play. So batters are going to have to keep at least 1 foot in the batter's box, except for there's a few instances where they're allowed to step out, getting hit by a pitch, foul ball. Well, hit by a pitcher on first base, but foul ball, a couple of different things. You're allowed to step out of the batter's box. Managers, the challenges no longer happen on the field. You stay in the dugout, which I think we all expected that to be the rule because that was turning into a farce last year. Ben, overall, I guess, is it a good idea? Are you in favor of shortening the length of games? Is this headed on the right track towards doing so as well?
Yeah, I think that anytime you can shorten the game a little bit, get it closer to, say, 2 hours and 45 minutes as opposed to 3 hours and 15, that's a good thing. Baseball games, there's so many of them. You don't want to drag them out with unnecessary pitching changes and adjustments of batting gloves and, you know, looking back into the dugout. I think you want to reduce that. And this is a step in that direction. So for me, it's a good sign. Whether it's going to be easy to enforce all these different things, stepping into the batter's box when you have guys who are trying to get themselves a little bit of extra time in that respect, might be difficult. But overall, a good step in the direction of shortening games.
And they've already implemented a couple of these things at the Arizona Fall League. They were able to shorten games by about 10 minutes, which is, I mean, a tremendous percentage when you look at it. 10 minutes, if they're able to do that during regular season Major League Baseball games, I mean, that's an impressive target to try and achieve. Another thing they're going to try and do as well is make sure everybody's ready to go immediately out of the commercial breaks. Like, guy's going to be in the middle of his throwing motion when they come back from commercial break. So it might be a couple of times that you actually miss the first pitch of an inning. But, yeah, they're trying to get away from those three-hour-plus games. Let's talk about the Blue Jays, though. Mentioned the pitchers and catchers report officially tomorrow. Ben, let's talk about you breaking some news, I guess, firstly. Minor league styles, you're all over the Blue Jays minor league system, but Max Pentecost, catcher of the future, part of that Hoffman draft, he had some issues health-wise and now more issues, apparently.
Yeah, he ended his season last year a little early, had some wrist issues, and after the season just had a bit of a shoulder cleanup, tried to see if that was working for him, but it just wasn't feeling the way he wanted it to. So they went back in there, did another shoulder cleanup just recently. And so the hope is that he's going to be throwing again within 3 months and hopefully doing baseball activities before that. But, you know, it is somewhat of a setback for a player that the Blue Jays selected in the first round last year along with Jeff Hoffman. So the hope is that he'll be, you know, back and in full season, getting those reps in and building his way up toward realizing his future as a very athletic catcher who can contribute on defense and also, you know, bring a real line drive approach to the game and be a good offensive player.
What's his future, though? I mean, they just signed Russell Martin to a long-term free agent deal, and I guess there's always the possibility that Martin could move off catcher, right? He's talked about wanting to play the infield later in his career, and I guess it depends on where the bat is, depending on if you can play that bat somewhere, whether it's third base, whether it's first base, whether it's wherever in the infield or the outfield. And we see a lot of guys drafted as catch. Carlos Delgado was drafted as a catcher, for God's sakes, okay? I mean, is there a possibility he moves off catcher?
I think Pentecost is a catcher. I think you draft him because he's a good receiver, someone who's athletic enough to stay at the position. You know, he gets compared to guys like Jonathan Lucroy, obviously a very good defender in his own right. So that would kind of be the ceiling. That would be if you're really dreaming what he becomes. Now, as for a timeline, clearly that's been pushed back a little bit right now.
Yep.
And maybe he's able to realize that within a few years. If that's the case, maybe you pair him with Martin. You never want a rookie catcher to shoulder the entire load to begin with. So maybe he eases in, and by the time Martin's contract is up, you have a guy who's ready to step in on a more full-time role.
And hasn't Anthopoulos in the past talked about stockpiling catchers and shortstops?
Yes.
As like trade
middle
chips?
Of the diamond. Yeah. Everybody's looking for something in the middle of the diamond.
So that could be, you know, his role in, you know, the coming years is sort of getting the Jays the piece that they need, you know, whether that's a top line starter or something like that. When Pentecost is coming up, if Russell Martin's still the guy behind the plate, then he winds up turning into something else.
Absolutely. Can't hurt.
Yeah. Travis Darno, got a Cy Young winner in return. Although, who knows if you Blue Jays... You know what? They would probably still do that deal. I think people already, you know, look at that as Blue Jays having buyer's remorse on R.A. Dickey. He's provided more at the major league level than Travis Darno or Noah Syndergaard have at this point.
Absolutely. And I think Dickey at this point, not going to be on anyone's favorites for Cy Young awards going forward, but he's an innings eater. He's someone who can help you win. Syndergaard's no pitches at the major league level so far. A very highly ranked prospect. He's got a big future ahead of him, but the Blue Jays wanted the piece that could help them win in the short term.
Has done so so far. At least he's been on the field and contributed. Maybe not at a Cy Young level, but you know what you're going to get out of him year to year. All right, so home opener sold out in about 90 minutes. I don't know if that's surprising or not, but Craig, I think it proves that there's still an appetite for this team in this city. And I know people were soured by the way things went a couple of years ago when they made all those big moves in the offseason and the R.A. Dickey move included. But when you sell out home opener in an hour and a half and you know, it still seems like there's buzz in this city for this team. It hasn't lost anything.
I think you're right. And I think not to drag the Maple Leafs back into this discussion, but...
Go ahead.
Well, the Maple Leafs, it seems, failed to do is to rebuild excitement about the team. They had the same core, they tried out the same core, and they shuffled the back-end pieces. What the Jays did this offseason that was super exciting is they went out and got, you know, a top five free agent. They went out and traded for Josh Donaldson. So you've got pieces in this team that people really want to see, like even down to like Michael Saunders and Justin Smoke. Just you're not trotting out Colby Rasmus again and Adam Lind. The guys that sort of we know what we're going to get from, and there's going to be a couple of bright spots during the season, but really they're not top end players. So I think part of the excitement around this team is just sort of seeing how the new guys fit and seeing how things play out. And those are big pieces. Josh Donaldson and Russell Martin are bona fide MLB players. So I think, yeah, the Toronto fan base has a justified positive outlook on this team.
You look at the top five that this team is going to trot out there on opening day of Jose Reyes, Russell Martin, Jose Bautista, Edwin Encarnacion, and Josh Donaldson. I mean, I don't even know if there is a discussion that's clearly the best in all major leagues of baseball. But you can argue about the bottom third of the lineup, and I would say that there's definitely some question marks. But top five, I mean, you're not going to find a better one than that.
I don't think you would. It's outrageously good. You could throw the Angels or the Tigers in that discussion. The Red Sox, of course, belong in any discussion about the best offenses in baseball. But, you know, the next time there's a competition for the best top five in baseball batting order, the Blue Jays are going to win it. I mean, that's not the goal, but it's going to get them closer to their ultimate goal, which is contending and ultimately reaching the playoffs. I think that lineup is going to be one of the biggest reasons that they are viewed as a contender.
Well, that being said, are they improved from a year ago?
Yeah.
A team that was on the outside of the playoffs looking in. I mean, the bullpen was so bad last year and maybe is what held them down second half of the season despite having a 6-game lead on the division. June 1st, they had the great May. But overall, you think they're improved?
Definitely. I mean, you look at last year, okay? Solid season and an improvement from the disastrous 2013 campaign. But they weren't a team... that had the kind of top-end talent that they do now. I mean, bringing in Russell Martin is going to have an impact not only offensively, 350 on base guy, but defensively, he's going to have a big impact on their young starting staff. Josh Donaldson, even if you buy Brett Laurie as a good big league player, and I do, he wasn't that player in 2014 for the Blue Jays. So what Josh Donaldson brings is a big-time upgrade over 2014 Brett Laurie. They're a club that looks like an 85, 87 game winner. And then you have a couple things break right. All of a sudden, they're right in that 90 win range and a team that could easily make the playoffs if they get a couple breaks.
What about this whole leadership thing? Shai Davidi wrote a story on the website, sportsnet.ca, and it was an impetus in signing Russell Martin, in grabbing Josh Donaldson, who did have his run-ins with front office there in Oakland as well, which can't be forgotten. But changing the clubhouse chemistry, changing the leadership and who's in charge and who the big voices are in that clubhouse seemingly was a big goal of this offseason. Craig, it's probably different in basketball because you actually have to pass guys the ball. You don't have to do that in baseball. But do you buy into that being one of this team's major problems from a year ago and maybe it being solved this year?
You know, I've always wondered in baseball, but I feel like, you know, you come to the building and, you know, guys are split into factions. Guys feel like loners. Guys don't work well together. They are less likely to take pointers. You know, your guy comes up to you in the locker room and says, dude, you know, like we need to figure out what we're missing on this shift, or, you know, you're, you know, way behind that hit. Why aren't you hitting the changeup? I'm not sure that those conversations are common, but you'd be much more likely to receive that from someone that you trusted and liked than you would be from a guy who you don't get along with in the first place. And it's probably just not going to happen. You're going to have fewer conversations, which leads to lesser improvement, lesser knowledge. And that's never a good thing. It always seemed to me like that team had cliques, and which, you know, anybody going back to high school, it's not the best way to feel comfortable in anything. And
sounds like you're talking from experience there, Craig.
Well, you know, my high school was vicious. The Nanaimo BC. Anyway, no, but, you know, a cliquey situation doesn't necessarily lend itself to communication or comfortability or chemistry. And I could see that being a problem. So you guys tell me, is this a better chemistry team? Like, is this built for...
Who knows? I think we're going to have to see on that one. I think last year wasn't ideal from a chemistry standpoint, but part of that goes hand in hand with losing. If you're losing
right
at a time that you expect to be winning, and the Blue Jays down the stretch were losing games they felt they should have been winning, they were very close at times during the season, so there was a lot of disappointment. That can go hand in hand. Certainly, guys like Russell Martin are going to have a good impact on this team. He brings a lot of experience, a lot of skill, which to me is the important thing. You can find experience anywhere. There are a lot of 37-year-old MLB veterans around there that have experience, but they don't have the same skill that Russell Martin does. He's going to make this team a better club, and I think with that, you'll get an improved vibe around the team.
Catcher is an interesting place to start with this team, because right now, Blue Jays seemingly have three that could be headed north with this team: Josh Tolley, Russell Martin, and Deonner Navarro, who's still on this team, who I'm kind of surprised is still on this team. Thought he would certainly garner some kind of return this offseason. We know Alex Anthopoulos was trying to move him, if not trying, very open to the possibility of moving him, because there were holes to be filled in the bullpen, and you had a trade piece. You had superfluous catchers, so why not trade one away for a bullpen arm? But as it stands right now, and it's not opening day right now, so things could change, Blue Jays seemingly have three catchers. Now, the question becomes whether R.A. Dickey needs his binky, right? Like, does he need Josh Tolley? And it seems that whatever R.A. Dickey's telling you, he really does want Josh Tolley on this team. And I know he says that it's not my decision, I don't put this roster together, and I'll throw to whoever. I mean, the fact remains, Josh Tolley continues to be on this team despite being a non-factor offensively. Now, I know it didn't go well opening day, J.P. Arencibia, when he tried to catch R.A. Dickey a couple of years ago, but I think you're doing a disservice if you think J.P. Arencibia is anything along the lines of the defensive catcher that Russell Martin is. But that being said, Ben, it's a different skill set to catch a knuckleball as to catch a conventional pitcher. I mean, if Russell Martin can show some sort of flashes of being able to do it in spring training, do we need to see it in the regular season, or does Josh Tolley need to at least start the season on this 25-man roster?
No, he doesn't need to start the season on the roster. He has options, and he's one guy that can give the Blue Jays some depth. He can get to know some of the young players at AAA Buffalo, and Deonner Navarro can be the backup catcher to Russell Martin. I think Martin is going to have the athleticism and the skill, not to mention the communication ability, to really relate to R.A. Dickey, get on the same page with him in spring training, and be an effective catcher of that knuckleball. And I think that's going to make the Blue Jays the best team that they can be, even if, and I understand why R.A. Dickey would want to throw to Josh Tolley. Tolley's been a tremendous part of his success with the Mets, with the Blue Jays. He is a very skilled catcher of that knuckleball, and that would probably allow Dickey to be the best pitcher that he can be. But for the Blue Jays to be the best team that they can be, I think you want to have Navarro, because he's a guy who can hit, especially against lefties. He gives you some offensive value. That's not something Tolley brings.
Is that a situation where you can live with him just being your backup catcher? Because, I mean, you mentioned there's offensive upside with Navarro, maybe more than there is with, I don't know, Justin Smoke. Who knows? Well, Justin Smoke certainly can't hit lefties, but who knows? He might factor in there as one of the better bats in that lineup and maybe garnering some DH time. Are you comfortable with the Blue Jays having two catchers in their lineup on any given day?
Sure. If it's against the left-handed pitcher, then absolutely. Against a right-hander, I think you want Smoke and Encarnacion covering first base and DH. And in some in some way. And I think that's the way it's going to unfold. But absolutely, you could have Navarro DHing against lefties, Danny Valencia. Right now, I think that's basically the way it would shape up.
This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Annis alongside Craig Battle and Ben Nicholson-Smith. I spoke to Michael Saunders the other day, last week. He joined me on the radio when I was filling in for Tim and Sid. Good dude, obviously. He's Canadian. He's going to be a good guy, naturally. There are no bad people in this country. But I asked a couple interesting things came out of that interview. One of them was talked about the stolen bases and how they were so down last year. And I know it was limited time, but last couple of years have been down in Seattle. Manchin was not given the green light, where in years previous he had been given the green light to take off whenever he felt like he had the ability to steal a base. Who knows whether that'll be the case this year. And another thing I asked him, it was about hitting against lefties, which throughout his career he's had difficulty doing, although he did it last year in very limited sample size because he was injured, had the oblique thing, did finish the season with the Mariners. Those two things, Ben, do you think this guy will be given free rein to run a little bit? Because we mentioned the bottom of the order is going to have some question marks, so maybe it's going to be a situation where they're going to have to create runs, whether it's through legs, whether it's whatever, and the hitting against lefties things. Do you think this is a situation where he does play against all comers all season long?
I think he's going to play against everyone. I think he's going to be that everyday guy in left field. And even on days when it's, you know, you're going up against Chris Sale, at least Saunders is going to give you a steady defensive player in left field. So I do think he'll play every day. And as for the running, I mean, to me, that's one of those stories that really is going to have to take shape in spring training. I think you give him the green light. You tell him to run all the time in spring training and get a sense for how much speed he has, what kind of reads he's getting off opposing pitchers. And if he looks good, great. Carry that into the regular season, see how it looks. If not, do what the Mariners did. I mean, they have some sound decision makers in Seattle, and if they felt that his speed wasn't up to the level it needs to be to have that green light, maybe that's something the Blue Jays will do too. But I think you start in spring training, see how he looks, and then go from there.
All right, the big question mark going into this season, this offseason, and the big area of concern, the big area that we thought this team would address is the bullpen. Really did nothing. I mean, they tried to get Ronald Belisario, and he wanted an extra $100K, ends up going to Tampa Bay. Something weird happened there, but maybe we'll never find out. So as it stands right now, you would assume that Brett Cecil, Aaron Loop, Steve Delabar, Marco Estrada, Chad Jenkins, Kyle Drabek, who's out of options, and Todd Redmond is your bullpen. Now, man, that doesn't sound, I mean, I'm not, if I'm Alex Anthopoulos, I don't know how comfortable I am going into opening day with that as my bullpen. Now, the big wild card is Aaron Sanchez, and you throw him into the mix, maybe it changes the dynamic. But are you surprised that this team really didn't do a whole lot with that bullpen? I know bullpens are a sine wave, and they go up and down, and who knows, guys can bounce back, like a guy like Steve Delabar, who was in the minor leagues for a good portion of last year. But to not take a flyer on somebody in that bullpen seems a little curious.
It does, and I am surprised. I think they missed a chance to upgrade a weakness on this team. And until they prove otherwise, I think it still projects as a weakness. That's not to say that those guys you mentioned can't bounce back. But if you're expecting someone like Kyle Drabek, who's had two Tommy Johns, or Steve Delabar, who couldn't command the ball last year, you know, or Rob Rasmussen, who's never really had extended time at the big league level, if you're expecting those guys to be the core of a bullpen, then expecting that 4.09 ERA to magically come down to 3.5 and be among the top bullpens in the league is just not realistic. So it could happen. The Blue Jays are hoping it will, and they have lots of bodies in spring training that they'll take a look at and hope for the best from. But at this point, that looks like probably one of the bigger weaknesses on an otherwise good team.
But hasn't the bullpen surprised both of the last 2 years? Like a couple of years ago, it was supposed to be weak, and it was one of the strongest parts of the team that was otherwise disappointing. Last year, they were supposed to be great, and of course, it all went to heck.
For sure. And I'm not saying that it couldn't bounce back and be a strong unit in 2015, but at the same time, it doesn't mean you just throw your hands up and say, well, I think that's why you see teams go out and spend on big-time relievers. And the Blue Jays had some interest in some of those big relievers out there. They monitored the market all offseason long, checking in on everyone from the top guys like Andrew Miller to the guys you mentioned like Belisario, who are commanding minor league deals.
So Axford.
Exactly. They checked in on Axford too. So they had some interest in these guys. It just didn't match up as far as price and what the Blue Jays' other needs are. So I think If you can add a Russell Martin, that's way more important to your team than adding a reliever. It just doesn't mean that you don't go out and add a reliever too if it's the right guy.
Well, and there are some guys still out there. K-Rod's still out there. Rafael Soriano. These are guys who I think Soriano is more than K-Rod is looking to, you know, rebound and rebuild their value. But, I mean, no spring chickens as well. And no guarantees. But that's what you get in the bullpen. So it shouldn't be a surprise when you're talking about guys not being guarantees. There's very few. I mean, there's not a lot of Mariano Rivera's out there. David Robertson, I guess, or Andrew Miller. Andrew Miller's had one good year.
Yeah.
But you look at some of the money thrown around to relievers this offseason. Kind of crazy stuff. I guess there's a possibility that some of the young arms could factor in here as well. And one of the names I keep hearing, Miguel Castro. Whether he's a starter, whether he's a reliever. I mean, is there a possibility this guy could break camp with this team opening day?
I think there is for sure. And I'm not saying it's a big possibility, but he was invited to big league camp. And they did that for a reason. The Blue Jays are very high on what Castro brings. Not a lot of experience at the upper minors so far in his career, but he's a guy who really impressed in Vancouver. And he's going to get a shot. So even if it's maybe a 5% chance that he actually comes north with the team, they're going to take a good long look at him as a potential 2015 contributor.
Let's ask you for the first time of like 7,000 before opening day or until the decision is made. Aaron Sanchez, bullpen or starting rotation? Because this is going to be the story of spring training, isn't it?
I agree completely. It will be the story of the spring. And for me, I can't even believe I'm saying this because Aaron Sanchez's long-term future is as a starter, but I would be tempted if I were the Blue Jays to take a look at Marco Estrada in the five spot. Let him be your J half of 2015. Have Daniel Norris open the season in Buffalo, get a couple months of seasoning, and have Sanchez be paired with Brett Cecil as your late inning option, who's coming in throwing 96-mile-an-hour sinkers that no one can touch, and have him face those late game situations along with Cecil. That would be my arrangement.
It seems like that's going to be the story of the spring. I can't think of another one. I mean, the Kyle Drabek one might be interesting because he's out of options. If he stinks it up in spring, maybe you're not so worried about losing him if he goes through waivers.
Right. And I think Kyle Drabek is certainly a guy who could slip through waivers at this point. It wouldn't surprise me. So, yeah, as far as Sanchez, I really think you got to take a look at him in spring. I'm not saying you go and slot him in on the first day of spring training and say you're going to be in the bullpen. You take a look. If he's commanding a secondary stuff, absolutely he's a guy who could light it up in the fifth role. But I think you need to see him command those secondary pitches.
Tail end of last season, he did come in and fill that bullpen role for the team. A small sample size. He was 10, 15 games, something like that. But that was a nice shining light towards the future for the team.
It was, and I am fully convinced that Sanchez can be a very effective reliever. I mean, the way he just pounded the zone with that 96-mile-an-hour sinking fastball, he can pitch in relief. I'm very convinced of that. I'm just not sure, and I think this is why you have to look at him in spring. I'm not sure, I don't know if you guys are, that he can have command of the secondary stuff to the point where he's making an impact as a starter.
Well, yeah, everything we've, well, you look at the numbers, and the control certainly wasn't where it was as a reliever. I expected him to come up to the major leagues and, yeah, be that, you know, 4 or 5 walks per 9 guy, and he wasn't that out of the bullpen because he was just pounding the fastball in there. Now, by all accounts, late in his minor league season a year ago, he made some tweaks that got him back into the zone with the secondary stuff. But, yeah, it is a question mark. I mean, he's already proven himself as an elite reliever, I think, even though it was a small sample size. The other guy, before we take the break, Daniel Norris, apparently shaved off the beard or is in the process of shaving off the beard. How does he factor in? Is it, I mean, because we know, you know, Grapefruit League games can also be fool's gold, right? How much of this is going to be an open tryout, an open competition, or has this team at least, if not made up its mind, has a pretty good idea of where it's going?
I think it is going to be an open competition. I really believe that. And they're going to see what Norris can offer. They're going to see what Sanchez and Estrada can. And because they didn't end up adding pitching to this team in the offseason, there are a lot of different arrangements that this pitching staff could take. So I think Norris is going to be really interesting to watch. And he's a guy for me that could end up being, even if he starts the season in the minors, a nice midseason addition to a pitching staff that will surely need a boost at some point.
And remember, a year ago, this team bided its time in calling up Aaron Sanchez even though it desperately needed arms in that bullpen. I imagine, Ben, knowing that the end might be near for Alex Anthopoulos, and if that's the case, John Gibbons as well, that there's not going to be any waiting around. I mean, if they come out of the gates with a couple of blown saves there, they're going to make a move, whether that's calling up Castro or doing something. It just, you can't let it snowball, I imagine, here in April.
And I think we saw last year that when prospects succeeded in the Blue Jays organization, they were not afraid to promote them aggressively.
Yep.
We saw it not only with Stroman and Sanchez last year,
but Pompey,
Daniel Norris. Those two guys started last season in the Florida State League. I mean, that fact to me, it never ceases to astound me that they made that progression from the Dunedin Blue Jays all the way to the big leagues in 1 year. So it might not even be just these guys. We could be seeing guys like Miguel Castro, Roberto Osuna, making that progression from the minors to big league contributors within the span of a few months.
Speaking of astounding things, NBA trade deadline was astounding as far as a volume perspective. We'll get into that. Who improved themselves the most, and has the balance of power in the Western Conference changed? All that and plenty more coming up before the top of the clock. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Craig Battle and Ben Nicholson-Smith, Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Brett Popplewell.
When the coach wasn't there for practice, I'd run practice. When I went to McGill, part of my way they helped me go to school was I taught instructional classes. I coached the professor's hockey team. So I was always that kind of person. You know, when I played on a ball team, I'd run the ball team.
Mike Babcock wants to be the best coach in his generation. I know this because he told me. Twice, in fact, as I sat on a stool in his kitchen. I spent 90 minutes in that kitchen, chatting with Babcock about his philosophy on life and the game, learning things about the man who has spent the last decade behind the Red Wings bench, like that he's a perfectionist who archives every game card from his more than 25 years as a coach. I know this because he showed them to me. He keeps them in his office next to the skulls of some of the bears and deer he's killed. There's an impression a lot of people have that Babcock doesn't smile, that he's a cold technician who's so focused on winning that he sometimes forgets about the people whose careers he's impacting. Babcock estimates that at any given time, one-third of his players are disgruntled with his leadership. It's a revolving third, he says. So what's the best part of Babcock's day? Family time, he says, and the start of the day, 5:50 in the morning when he wakes up and heads to the arena to work out. And what's the worst part of his job? Retiring superstars, he says. Depending which headline you're reading, Babcock is destined to become the next coach of the Pittsburgh Penguins, Toronto Maple Leafs, or pretty much any other team in the NHL. So what does the future hold for hockey's most employable man? And why is he so focused on finding perfection? Read my story and find out.
This story and more appears in the latest edition of Sportsnet Magazine, available on Next Issue and in the Apple Newsstand.
Make up your mind. Decide to walk with me.
Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I am Ben Ennis alongside Craig Battle and Ben Nicholson-Smith. The NBA's trade deadline has come and gone. Raptors didn't do anything. The Hawks didn't do anything, but just about everybody else did. 37 players sent one place or another, and when you consider the small roster sizes of NBA teams, it's an incredibly large percentage. Craig, overall, who made the biggest impact? Who changed their fortunes, the way you look at them, the most after what happened on Thursday?
In the immediate future, it seemed like it was the Miami Heat. We talked before about Chris Bosh potentially being lost for the season. But grabbing Goran Dragic from Phoenix for what could wind up being two lottery picks, they're really mortgaging the future for a win-now move. That is an absolutely terrifying starting lineup, and we talked about it before. Milwaukee traded arguably their best player and grabbed some sort of depth, and Michael Carter-Williams from the 76ers, who was last year's Rookie of the Year. So they got longer. They got bigger up front. They've lost Larry Sanders for the year. They lost Jabari Parker for the year. So they added a center from Phoenix, one of the Plumlee brothers, Miles, to shore up their front court. So that's an interesting move for them. All the teams at the bottom of the Eastern Conference playoff picture made moves. Washington grabbed Ramon Sessions as their backup point guard. Brooklyn grabbed Thaddeus Young for a really aging, disinterested Kevin Garnett. Detroit grabbed Reggie Jackson from the Oklahoma City Thunder, where he was sort of languishing on the bench. So a lot of those teams that, you know, the Atlantas or the Torontos or the Chicagos of the world will be playing in the first round, upgraded pieces. Oklahoma City, I think, is the other big, big winner. They took Kendrick Perkins, who is having an okay season, but has been pretty bad for quite a few years.
It's tough to be in the NBA when you can't make a layup.
You can't make a layup.
It's difficult.
You're 6'10", you know, like, come on. Yeah, standing, when they leave you wide open, standing right under the basket, you know there's something wrong. So they were able to grab Enes Kanter from Utah. And Utah was possibly scared off by Enes Kanter because of sort of the discussion around his inflated sense of self and the amount of money he's expecting in the offseason. But for once, Oklahoma City took a guy who is a free agent in the offseason and grabbed him rather than, like, they traded away James Harden before he was a free agent. They traded away Jeff Green before he was a free agent. Eric Maynor, they're doing the same thing with Reggie Jackson now. But they actually grabbed one of those guys for a playoff push. They're the eighth seed now. They're not going to relinquish it. So they're a playoff team, and they're hoping to beat whether it's Memphis or Golden State or Portland, whoever they wind up playing. And so they actually added pieces. They shipped off Reggie Jackson and got DJ Augustine as their backup point guard. We've seen the last season and a half how, you know, given an opportunity, he can be a quite good point guard. He plays better as a starter, but he's not starting in Oklahoma City. But he gives them insurance, and he allows them to have secondary scoring now that Reggie Jackson's gone. So they got much better, and I think Miami really, really did mortgage the future. But immediately they got better if they can keep Bosch in the lineup.
As far as the top teams, though, Raptors, Hawks, Chicago didn't do a whole heck of a lot. Cavs, I guess they already made their moves this season. Western Conference, Golden State, Memphis didn't do anything. Portland, a little bit of tinkering. But the big teams weren't the ones making a splash. Was there anybody in that crop that you thought, man, really a tweak here or there, a bigger move could have really changed their fortunes? Are you surprised there was no real significant movement among the top teams in the NBA?
I think because you said it, a lot of those teams had made their moves. Like, nobody was expecting Cleveland. Like, they've already given away every first-round pick they've got. You know, Chicago got Pau Gasol in the offseason. They got Mirotić. They're loaded, so they could potentially move out pieces, but they didn't really need anything. Atlanta had a big offseason just in terms of solidifying who they were, and they were playing so hot to find a piece that fits and works. And, you know, we talked about in baseball chemistry, but in basketball chemistry is massive for a system that works like Atlanta's does, right? Everybody needs to be on the same page, whipping the ball around. Bringing in somebody into that ecosystem, I think, would have been kind of challenging. Golden State, they don't need anything, you know. Like, they've got the best backcourt in the NBA. They're loaded. They've got David Lee and Andre Iguodala coming off the bench. Maurice Spates is, you know, like a potential most improved player. These teams just didn't have glaring needs that needed to be addressed. It's interesting that the Portland grabbed Aaron Aflalo from Denver to shore up their secondary scoring. So that could be a big move for them. They're only 3.5 back of Memphis and 8 back of Golden State. So, you know, they're there, but they're also tied with Houston. They're a half game up on the Clippers in Dallas. So adding a nice secondary piece like that will help them sort of maintain their spot, their third spot in the West.
What the hell's going on in Philadelphia with the 76ers? Honestly. Okay, so here's what happens. They trade away Michael Carter-Williams and KJ McDaniels. They get a first-round pick from the Lakers, top five protected in 2015, protected 1-3 in 16 and 17, unprotected 2018. The lesser of Denver or Minnesota's 2015 second-round pick, first-round pick from Oklahoma City, protected 1-18 2015, 1-15 2016, 2017, becomes two second-round picks if not conveyed by 2018. JaVale McGee, second-round pick from Denver. Isaiah Kanaan, second-round pick from Houston. What the hell's going on there? How many picks can you possibly want? Like, at some point, you have to turn that into wins, don't you?
At some point, you absolutely do. But the last couple of years they've drafted injured guys like Nerlens Noel didn't play last season. He's a rookie this season. They drafted Joel Embiid, who is injured this season. They drafted Dario Saric out of Europe, who isn't in the NBA this season, might not be in the NBA next season. Like, this is a team that's playing so far down the road that it's actually kind of amazing that, you know, the fan base is apparently on board with the tanking and the overall strategy of this team. But there is going to be a point where you're going to need to turn it into wins. Like you said, like, you can't have that many rookies on your team. You don't need that many young players. They're already stocked up with young players now and in the future. But what I think what happened with Michael Carter Williams is they saw a league that valued him more than they did. If they're looking sort of at analytics based, they're thinking they want shooting. They want to pass the ball around like the Atlanta Hawks do. And Michael Carter Williams is a guy who can get into the paint. He's big, but he's not a shooter. And some people are saying that he's never going to be a shooter. And I guess that's up to Jason Kidd now in Milwaukee to fix. But they saw a league that they could get a first round pick for him. And it's only protected top 1 to 5. So it could be even as high as 6 this season.
I don't know why you would buy a ticket to a Sixers game for the next 5 years, but apparently, actually not many people will. But apparently there is a plan in place. It's just a confusing one. Also, big news. It's finally official. It's been speculated for months, but Manny Pacquiao will fight Floyd Mayweather on May 2nd. Now, I'm not a huge boxing guy, not into MMA really either. But that being said, and I know this thing's going to cost, it's going to be like the most expensive pay-per-view of all time. It's going to be about $100. It's American, so probably a little bit more in this country. So you got to get a whole bunch of buddies, a whole crew of buddies at your place pitch in on this thing, unless you just feel like blowing $100. I'm intrigued. I'm going to find myself watching it if I have the day off. Ben, I don't know. Are you a boxing guy? Does this intrigue you?
It definitely intrigues me. I wouldn't call myself a boxing guy, but this kind of fight, I think, is definitely intriguing. And even the fact that it's $100 pay-per-view, almost in a weird way, that makes me want to watch it more than I otherwise would, because I feel like, you know, if it's on at a bar, or you're at a friend's house or something, it's not like you're throwing down the whole $100 to watch a fight, but it still makes it, it shows it's such a marquee event. It's been long anticipated. Obviously, they had to negotiate and figure things out between the two camps. And now that it's going to happen, I think it'll be a pretty interesting fight.
It's almost like a pop culture event there, Craig.
Yeah. How many fights can you make between crossover successes in boxing? Like, this is the one fight, you know, like, you go back to the days of Muhammad Ali when every other fight seemed like, you know, you look back on it now and it seemed like he was fighting like a be all end all kind of. Pacquiao.
Tyson kind of did it too. Tyson had some excitement there.
Sure. Absolutely. But these are the bygone days of boxing. Like,
yeah.
You know, in terms of crossover, you know, the guys that the average sports fan can talk about confidently, they just don't exist. So you got this fight made between these two people that's been put off for 5 years. You know, the bad thing is that people are saying it's just not going to be the same fight it would have been if Manny Pacquiao was fighting him in his prime. But at the same point, you've got two people that the average sports fan is super familiar with and wants to see fight going into the same ring together. It's amazing.
Yeah, if they were in walkers, I think we'd still watch this thing, right?
Absolutely.
Just from names alone.
Sure.
Yeah, it's a shame it didn't happen 5 years ago, but in a sense, and I think they both said this, it's almost a little more intriguing that it's been building up for so long, and now it is finally going to get done May 2nd, and you can all come to my house. We'll all watch it together, okay?
Nice. That sounds great.
We'll split it, though. That'll do it for Sportsnet Magazine Live. I've got an edition of Sportsnet Today coming up next. This is the Sportsnet Radio Network.